I'm Daniel Kaplan. I represent the appellant, Kendrick Begay. I'm going to try and watch my time and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. At the trial in this case, the government's approach to the question of premeditation was to argue to the jury in the closing argument that intent to kill is equivalent to premeditation. As the panel in this case pointed out, that's not correct. Intent to kill shows malice aforethought, but not premeditation. At the initial appeal in this case, the centerpiece of the government's approach to premeditation was to state that there was evidence in the record about Mr. Begay's demeanor at the time of the shooting, that his demeanor was calm, methodical, and thoughtful, and that established premeditation. As the panel in this case pointed out, there is no such evidence in the record. Now, at this en banc stage of this case, the government's approach in its en banc petition is essentially to say that if all conceivable inferences in favor of premeditation that can be drawn from the evidence are drawn the way the government would like them to be drawn, there is some evidence that tends to indicate premeditation. That also is not correct, and the reason is that has been rejected in a line of cases going all the way.
I don't understand why you need all permissible inferences. Why isn't it enough that the guy's seen talking to the two victims or the future victims? He then walks back to his truck, pulls out a long gun, walks back, and shoots him.
Because
why isn't that alone enough to show premeditation? I mean, he takes an action of going back to get a weapon that is capable of being used for killing people, and in fact, he uses it to kill people. Why isn't that enough? And for just forgetting anything else, demeanor, calmness, anything else?
The law recognizes that there are at least three different interpretations of the act of what you're describing, grabbing the gun and coming back and shooting it. There are at least three different interpretations of facts like that, what kind of a homicide that could be.
But if one of them is that you premeditated, why isn't the government entitled to that inference in terms of the standard of review here?
Because there's nothing about those facts, as the Chief Judge just stated them, that tends to show that there was, in fact, premeditation. It could have been a killing on impulse, which would, of course, be second-degree murder.
Does it preclude premeditation? Is there something about that set of facts that says premeditation is not a possible inference?
No.
So what Judge Callahan's question is, and my question is, if that's a possible inference, why isn't that for the jury? The jury here heard it, and that's the inference it drew. If it was a permissible inference, why isn't that the end of the case?
All the way back to
On this issue. We can talk about the argument of the prosecutor and all that separately.
Okay. Going all the way back to Jackson versus Virginia, at the same time that the Supreme Court issued its seminal ruling on what sufficiency of the evidence is, it also first said that it was definitively rejecting the sum evidence standard. Sum evidence that passes the Rule 401 standard of making guilt slightly more probable and makes it admissible and relevant is not good enough.
I think you've crossed that bridge. When you say that's a permissible inference, that's not like saying, these were Martians that came down. Oh, it's possible. This is a permissible inference. When you say it's a permissible inference, that means it's an inference that one can permissibly draw from these facts.
I'm not saying it's a permissible inference.
I don't mean to put the words in your mouth. I'm trying to get an answer.
Okay. The answer I'm giving you is that I'm not disputing the idea that those facts are deemed relevant. Okay, they would be admissible in the trial as tending to go toward premeditation. They are not nearly enough to make the inference permissible he actually premeditated.
Why not?
He had time to deliberate.
Yes, I believe he had time.
And if he had the time, why can't a jury presume that while he's walking back from the car to the truck, that he was thinking about what he was doing?
There's no evidence to support that.
Well, he wasn't stroking his chin in thought, but his behavior appears to be goal-directed. had a conversation in the car. You said he had the time to deliberate. He goes back and gets a gun and goes back. Why isn't that at least permissible that he was thinking about what he was doing when he was walking to the truck?
Well, as the D.C. Circuit pointed out in the Austin case, which was discussed in the panel decision, time to premeditate is not sufficient. It still leaves nothing but a speculative leap to say there was premeditation.
What more would you have needed? Him talking out loud or leaving a note or something like that?
Well, for example, anything in those classic three categories that the panel discussed, which typically have been required to show premeditation, motive, planning, the manner of killing being something which tends to indicate that there was.
Well, how about all the shots, then, if you want to talk about the manner of killing?
The number of shots is quite consistent with a killing that was done in a rage or in a passion.
Well, is it also consistent with you plan to get the job done?
Yeah, but
okay,
in
then
and of
why
itself,
isn't that a permissible inference that the government would be entitled to?
Because on this evidence, the jury can only speculate that the number of shots were somehow executing a plan. In fact, it's more consistent
I guess from the standpoint when you're saying that, it could be both, but Mr. Begay didn't testify, so we can't speculate as to what he would do. But when people are, two people in a car looking at the business end of a weapon and, eight or nine shots go off, that certainly doesn't seem accidental. I mean, that seems an inference that a jury would be able to make.
Well, Your Honor, the testimony was that there were eight or nine shots, and two or three of those missed, even though he was standing only 3 to 4 feet away. And he had a collection. He had some guns. He had numerous guns. He had numerous rifles. He had gone shooting with his friend Lauren Clark at least a couple of times. The fact that he misses a couple of times, two or three times, suggests that he's not acting in a very calm and deliberate way, the way someone who's premeditating would do.
Well, that's a good argument to the jury. I mean, that's what. But then on the other side of it, I've seen cases where officers are trying to shoot someone and they unload their whole magazine and they don't hit a darn thing. And, just because someone's a bad shot doesn't mean that they aren't planning to do something.
Well, have you ever gone to the gun range and missed the target altogether?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever gone to the gun range and missed the target altogether? I do it all the time. Just nothing. You pull it back, there's not a hole there.
Again, it's speculation. That's the essential problem. We're speculating. Maybe he's a bad shot. Maybe he missed. The jury had nothing but speculation.
What do we do with the prior incidents? Do we ignore the fact that these two cars engaged in activity, the driver's driving them, obviously, but that is inconsistent with an unplanned get-together? In other words, why do two cars coming at each other on a highway make U-turns and then pull off together onto a side road? That's not normal highway behavior. If you wanted to flip somebody off and they both got angry and whatever, there's no evidence that people boiled out of the cars and started shouting and yelling. So can the jury take those circumstances into account and say, this is more than just a happenstance meeting and there must have been something going on between these? I mean, yes, it's speculation, but it's a fact, isn't it? It's something that the jury would weigh into the balance.
These are facts that the jury certainly could weigh and that the court can weigh in deciding whether there was sufficient evidence, but I would seize upon what you said about it being speculation. It is speculation.
What's the difference between speculation and permissible inference?
Well, the court addressed that in the Juan H. case, which I filed with the 28-J letter last week, and which was cited with approval in this court's en banc decision in Nevels that came out towards the end of last week. It said in that case that a reasonable inference, which is the only type that is permissible in sufficiency of the evidence review, that goes beyond speculation, is one that's supported by a chain of logic. It's not mere speculation dressed up in the guise of evidence. And what we're essentially doing here is trying to make that distinction, and all there is in this record in terms of finding premeditation and deliberation is what counts as mere speculation in the guise of evidence. Nothing you can back up with a chain of logical inference.
When you say that Jackson versus Virginia rejected the sum evidence rule, what you're saying is, as I understand it, that the beyond a reasonable doubt requirement plugs in here someplace. i.e., that there has to be enough evidence that somebody could think it was beyond a reasonable doubt, right? So what I'm having trouble with is it seems to me that the facts that have been talked about would tend in the direction of showing that there was premeditation, or could if somebody chose to infer it in that direction. But the question is, what is the sort of the – how does the inference role play and interact with the beyond a reasonable doubt standard? I mean, is what you're really saying is, yes, you could infer that it's a – you could say that these things support it, but they don't support it beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that what you're saying?
Well, essentially that's what I'm saying. And I'm also saying that these are facts which would fit into a case for premeditation if more facts or different type of facts were also present. As the panel pointed out, if there were facts in this record which tended to show planning, a manner of killing which suggested premeditation, or even just motive, if there were any of that together with these other facts, then the jury could get to the stage where it could reach that inference of premeditation without just
making a speculative leap. Why isn't going back to the car and retrieving the rifle enough to show planning?
Because there's nothing about that that suggests planning. I mean, it...
Are the people in the car armed?
Beg your pardon?
Are the people in the car armed?
There's no evidence that they were.
All right. So why isn't going back to the car to get a gun when you have unarmed people in the car? Why isn't that another fact?
It's a fact that indicates that at that point, he developed the intent to kill, went and got the gun and came back and did it. Now, intent to kill would get you to second-degree murder if he were provoked by something that happened while he was standing next to the car, maybe talking to
him. Well, but if there are two dead people and there's no weapons in the car, that, you know, I think an inference from that is that no one pulled a gun on him. So an inference that the government would be entitled to at that point, he ascertains that they don't have guns, then he goes back to the car to get the gun. He knows, you know, he's bringing a gun to a knife fight or something less. So, you know, why isn't that enough?
There was no argument of self-defense here. There was no claim that this was anything like an accidental killing. That's only enough to get you to what was already the bottom line, the starting point, of there was apparently an intentional homicide, which could have been provoked.
You said more. You said he developed an intent to kill. It's one thing to say he's there at the car, he pulls out the gun instantaneously, kills them, and it's intentional. But when he develops an intent to kill, why isn't that premeditation? He develops an intent to kill. He goes to get his gun. He says, I can't kill him with my bare hands, so I'm going to go get the gun, and I'm going to carry out that intent. Why isn't the development of the intent and then the action of going and getting the weapon, why isn't that premeditation right there?
Because still, it only gets you to second-degree murder or potentially voluntary manslaughter. The intent to kill...
Yeah, I wasn't talking about that. I'm asking for meditation. Why isn't developing an intent to kill and then acting upon it by going to go fetch a gun to carry out that intent, why isn't that premeditation?
Because, again, really that only shows that there was an intent to kill that he executed on in... just the time it took. There was testimony about how far the cars were apart. The witness stated that it was...
It doesn't matter if they're across the street from each other. The point is, he's there, he's talking to them, he goes to fetch his gun, and comes back to shoot them. Why isn't sort of turning around, going to your car to get the weapon, coming back with it and pulling the trigger, why isn't that premeditation right there? Well, how much premeditation do you need?
There's nothing about that that shows that he's acting with a cool mind, capable of reflection, that he is in fact reflecting. Well, that's the answer.
Also, address the fact that I was really struck that he originally went and spoke on the driver's side, and then walked back, reached under his car, got the gun, and then walked around to the passenger side where Tolleman, I guess, was sitting, and then shot that way. And that definitely seems some planning. He didn't just go right back. He went around the car to the other side.
Well, again, it's not enough to really be able to make a solid inference that he was planning. It's simply the distance between the two cars was, according to the testimony, comparable to the distance from the lawyer's podium to the witness stand in the courtroom.
But how does going around the car to the other side of the car fit in with your theory that there was no planning?
There could have been provocation while he was standing by the car, which was he might have been provoked by the victim that he shot at,
counsel,
the passenger.
Isn't your argument,
that's why, and the gun.
Isn't your argument about provocation entirely provocation, but there's no
Judge Wardlow, I can't hear you. Could you just please? I'd like to hear the question.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Thank you.
Okay. Isn't you keep saying there could have been provocation, but isn't that entirely speculative also? I mean, what's the evidence of provocation?
Well, the strongest affirmative evidence of provocation were two things. First of all, as we discussed, he missed 2 to 3 times from only 3 to 4 feet away, and there was evidence that he had multiple guns.
Why is that evidence of provocation?
Because it suggests he's shooting in a rage, not calmly.
Why? I still don't understand why shooting that manner is shooting in a rage.
A person who's overcome with passion and rage wouldn't be holding the gun very still or thinking clearly enough to think, I should just make him get out of the car and put it up against his head and do it cleanly,
etc. Speculation on speculation now, not only beginning with the provocation Judge Wardlaw talked about, but now you're sort of adding. It seems to me that you use inference and speculation interchangeably depending on whether it helps your case, which seems to go back to could a reasonable juror make the inference. So I want to start way back. It seems to be evidence from the female witness that they were at the same party, correct?
The victims and the defendant?
Yes.
No, actually that
Is that unclear? Or what is your view on that?
I didn't see anything in the record which suggests the victims were at the party.
Okay. And what about the flashing lights on the highway? I mean, that suggests an effort. Do you think it's a reasonable inference that when somebody flashes their lights at you, that they're directing it at your car?
Yes. And there was nobody else on the road at the time.
And nobody else was on the road. And the flashing of the lights basically caused both cars to kind of turn around and then come back together on this little side.
First they passed each other and they both turned around. Then Begay flashed his lights.
Then he flashes his lights and then they come together.
Yeah.
So starting with that, he is targeting this car, maybe not for murder, but he's targeting the car, correct?
It appears that he had some business he wanted to take up with the people in the car, yeah.
So that begins the chain of events, right? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. But so in your view, what would he need if you had no words spoken, either because nobody heard them and we don't have anybody testifying, what in your view in this circumstance would you need to meet the planning prong? You said you need more evidence.
Look at practically any of the cases that the government cited in its rehearing petition. Every one of those involved facts like procuring the knife weeks ahead, disabling the victim's car. Anything like that could have shown planning as an example of that type of premeditation evidence.
And you don't think planning can, if you have time to cogitate, which you've indicated there is, you don't think it's sufficient planning to be talking to someone and then to affirmatively, instead of going back to your car and driving away, you affirmatively go back, you pick up the gun, and you carry it back to the car. That's not planning?
There's nothing about that which suggests it's planning as opposed to a killing on impulse or a killing under provocation.
So all three of those would be permissible inferences?
Well, all three of those are consistent with that evidence, and there's nothing about the evidence which allows a jury beyond a reasonable doubt to pick the premeditation interpretation.
Okay, well, so they're consistent with the evidence, but then there's more evidence than just the picking up of the gun. So then is the question, going back to Judge Berzon, are you really arguing the inferences are consistent but not strong enough to meet beyond reasonable doubt? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The inferences, just like in the Juan H. case, just like in the Penagos case, both of which are still good law after this Court's Nevels decision, the inferences are just unduly speculative. There's just not enough there.
No, but that's different. I mean, each inference
First of all, an inference can be a stronger inference or a weaker inference. In other words, one of the examples that somebody gave you where they said if you don't see any guns in the car afterwards, is there an inference that these people have no guns? That's still an inference, but it's a very, very strong inference, right? If, on the other hand, if somebody goes back to get the gun and then and comes back, there is some inference that he may have planned it, but it's not, it doesn't eliminate many other possibilities. So there are stronger and weaker inferences, first of all. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then there are the aggregation of the inferences, i.e., whether the inferences, once you've made them and given their strength or weakness, how, whether they add up to beyond a reasonable doubt. And to keep saying that each one of them isn't enough is not the solution. The question is whether, given the strength of the inferences and their aggregation, could somebody find beyond a reasonable doubt? And you haven't really addressed that question.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that
But you keep knocking down each individual one, and that's not helpful.
Well, I'm addressing each individual one because logically it's necessary to discuss them. But even I agree with you that there's a further hurdle the government has to pass here. The evidence, the individual inferences have to be something that gets you up to, you know, the point where it's not just speculation. And then at the second stage of the Jackson analysis under Nevels, you have to ask, is this more than a modicum?
Speculation, they can still be weak, right?
Absolutely. And if you get to the second stage, and all you have is a handful of weak inferences and what amounts to a modicum of barely relevant evidence, it's not good enough for a reasonable person to find premeditation beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that this evidence would fail under the first threshold and would also fail if it passed that under the second threshold.
Is there any evidence of provocation?
The evidence that indicated provocation was two things. The affirmative evidence, the strongest affirmative evidence, was essentially, again, the missing 2 to 3 times out of 8 to 9 shots.
That's your evidence of provocation, that the guy missed?
The fact that he was only 3 to 4 feet away, apparently an experienced shooter, and missed.
What other evidence of provocation do you have besides the fact that the guy missed a couple of shots?
The fact that he was standing for about a minute by the side of the car before he apparently developed the intent to kill suggests that there must have been provocation, or there could have been provocation at that point. Now, if I could turn to the second issue, which is the lesser-included instruction, assuming that the court were to find that this evidence gets over the threshold that it was enough for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was premeditation, it would clear that threshold without a lot of space to spare, I would expect.
Didn't trial counsel tell the judge that there was no evidence of provocation at ER 32?
Yes, but that's not the standard. First of all, it's not true, because there was the missing 2 to 3 times, which is evidence of provocation, and the apparently talking for a minute before developing the intent to kill.
But it's an abuse of discretion standard, and generally your client did not testify. Had your client, obviously if your client had testified and said, we argued, you know, I was frightened, any number of things, then the court is really put in a situation where there's some evidence that there was something going on. But here, on an abuse of discretion, I'm not sure how we can say that the court was required to give that instruction when your client didn't testify, didn't put any provocation, the lawyer that was there said there's no evidence of provocation. How can we say that the district judge abused his discretion?
The lawyer was not correct about that. The standard is, if there's some evidence, this court is not permitted to weigh the evidence and decide whether it is convinced that the missing 2 to 3 times tends to suggest provocation.
With regard to the second-degree murder, the provocation would be helpful but doesn't matter. Is that right?
I think that's correct.
Whereas as to voluntary manslaughter, that's the only way you would get there. Is that right?
Well, technically, you can also get there with an irrational state of mind. That's the Kleeman case. But the evidence, I will concede, doesn't suggest that he was irrational.
What is the other way is if you think you have the right to defend yourself, but you don't really, right? That's one.
That'll get you there, too. But, again, the evidence doesn't tend to support that either.
And the person clearly holds the belief that they were defending themselves, but it's not rational. That's one way. And the other has to be provocation, right? That they're responding in a heat of passion.
Right. And there was some evidence. Again, this court is not permitted to weigh the evidence and decide whether missing 2 to 3 times should be good enough for them if they were jurors. It only is supposed to ask whether there is some evidence which a jury could seize upon to decide that there was provocation. And there was the missing, and there was the apparent conversation which apparently gave birth to the intent to kill. Beyond that, even if there weren't that affirmative.
Would the burdens be different on the second-degree murder and on the voluntary murder with respect to provocation? As I understand what you're saying as to second-degree murder is that the government has to produce something that demonstrates that it was premeditation rather than heat of passion. And so the possibility of provocation in that point isn't something you have to demonstrate. It's just that the government would have to negate it or and or provide something else that would give you demonstrate that he was acting with a cool mind. But as to voluntary manslaughter, isn't a burden on you as to the provocation?
Well, I believe the law, the case law indicates that the defendant, if he raises the question of provocation, then the burden is on the government to show there wasn't provocation.
All right. Did he raise it?
And he didn't raise it. So that's not what I'm relying on here. What I'm relying on is cases going back to the Stevenson case in the Supreme Court that say, regardless of what the defendant raises, if there was some evidence which would have enabled a rational jury to find that it was voluntary manslaughter, that instruction must be given. There is no weighing the evidence. There is it must be given.
Instruct if there's evidence that would indicate that that should be there. But that doesn't mean speculation upon speculation upon speculation. I mean, it has to rise to a certain level, exactly what that level is here. And here, when the defendant didn't put anything on, said there's no provocation, and it's an abuse of discretion standard, it seems to me you're pushing a pretty heavy rock uphill.
I just want to make one more brief comment and save the rest of my time responding to that. This Court's decision in Hernandez, as well as the Quintero decision and a D.C. Circuit's decision in Comer, they all dealt with kind of a black box scenario. There was no affirmative evidence tending to show that the lesser was correct, but there was just a black hole. There was a mystery there. And in cases like that, like this, arguably, the instruction for the lesser included must be given. In Quintero, they said even if it's unclear about the lesser included, it must be given. And at least that case law would apply here. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time.
We'll hear from the government. You must be Mr. Lopez.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is John Lopez. I represent the United States in this matter. Based upon the evidence as a whole, and in light of the very favorable and deferential standard for the government as set forth in Jackson and recently reiterated by this Court in Nevels, the jury was entitled to find premeditation based upon a number of points, including the following: that there was, as Judge Kaczynski pointed out, sufficient evidence of premeditation from the time that the defendant stood next to the victim's car immediately prior to the shooting, that the jury was entitled to reject the defendant's claim for the first time on appeal that the defendant acted in a frenzy at any point.
Could you explain to me the interplay between provocation and premeditation, at least the government's position on this? Let's say that the defendant is standing there, which seems to be undisputed. He's standing there by the side of the window and looks like some conversation is taking place. I mean, it's very likely that they talked because he wasn't just standing there. And let's say something is said during that conversation that makes him angry. He's called a name, or, you know, something is said that one would call provocation. How does that relate to premeditation? Does that negate premeditation? Does it invite premeditation? And let's say then what happens is, as the facts show, he goes back to his car, reaches under the seat of his, truck, I guess, yes? Truck?
In the back seat of his truck.
Okay, so he reaches in under the back seat of the truck, he pulls out a rifle, comes back and shoots him, and let's imagine that it's because of something that was said during that 1 minute or so that he conversed. How do those two interplay?
The fact of provocation, and again, speaking in hypothetical terms because there's no evidence of provocation in this case, the fact of provocation does not per se eliminate a finding or preclude a finding of premeditation. It depends on the circumstances of the case. All that's required to prove first-degree murder is that the defendant formed the intent to kill and had an opportunity to reflect and based upon the evidence as a whole.
So can you be provoked into a premeditated killing? So I mean, let's say he something is said to him. Let's say he's called a very offensive name, and it makes him very angry. It makes him shaky. It makes him, you know, and he very upset. And he then heads back, gets his rifle, comes back and shoots, and maybe shoots erratically because he is angry. Does that negate premeditation?
No, Your Honor. I submit that that absolutely does not preclude a finding of premeditation. For example, in the Sinclair case, the Fourth Circuit case, although there is a temporal distinction between the facts of this case and that case, the defendant got in a bar fight with the victim, apparently left the club, was gone only a matter of minutes, retrieved a weapon, apparently returned to the club, and killed the victim. I submit that in that case, there was clearly evidence of provocation. There was a bar fight. I don't know the cause of the fight, but there was a fight. There was clearly provocation, and the Fourth Circuit found over the defendant's argument that there was premeditation despite the defendant's claim that the defendant was acting in a rage as a result of the provocation from the fight.
Well, first of all, you said at one point that there has to be an opportunity to reflect. That's not good enough. There has to be an actual reflection, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, based upon
So the fact that you have an opportunity to reflect is not sufficient.
The opportunity alone is not sufficient. Right. The government.
Right. So the real problem here is what kind of evidence is a vacuum sufficient to allow the jury to draw the inference that, although we don't have any idea what he was thinking when we don't know what happened to the car, and we don't know what he was thinking when he went back, and the usual things that are that tend to show premeditation are in here. We have basically, most obviously, we have no idea what the motive was. Can they fill that vacuum with the notion that he was thinking about it when he went back without some more evidence of that? It's a very ephemeral thing. There's no doubt about it. But
yes, Your Honor, I submit that's the case. There's no requirement, as the Court is aware, of evidence of motive. It's not an element and it's not required. In this particular case, yes, the defendant's actions after he stood at the victim's car indicate that there was thought involved. He certainly had the time, as appellant's counsel concedes.
Well, he certainly thought, I'm going to go get my gun and kill those people, that's sure. But apparently premeditation has another element, that a very ephemeral element.
The second thought, the reflection.
Right. Okay. And what is there about this that will allow them to say beyond a reasonable doubt that that occurred?
The defendant's actions were incremental. Lauren Clark at ER 404 testified that there was a substantial distance between the vehicles.
Can you clear up one fact for me?
Yes.
While you're relaying the series of facts that you argue support premeditation. In your petition for rehearing, you say that agents learn that the defendant may have been at the same party with O.C. and J.T. Was there actual evidence of that they were or were not at that same party in Greasewood?
That is unclear.
Was there evidence in the record? Because you say that agents learn that they may have been at the party. Is that the testimony that's in the record, that they may have been at the same party?
I can't cite the court to evidence in the record that they were at the same party.
So they were not, I mean, the evidence in front of us is that they were not at the same party?
That is, given the lack of affirmative proof that they were at the party.
You've got to say yes or no. Either there's evidence in the record that shows, it's just a fact, you know. There's either evidence in the record.
There's not evidence in the record.
Okay, there's not evidence in the record as to that. Is there any evidence as to who O.C. was and who J.T. was? Because I, like Judge Ikuda, find it interesting that the defendant went up and he stopped the car. It was O.C.'s car. And O.C. was driving. O.C. was female. He went to her side of the car and then talked, I don't know, to them or whoever he talked to. And then he walked back and then he came back and he went to JT's side of the car and shot at JT first.
Correct.
So is there any evidence about who these people are, what their relationship is, or anything like that?
There is not evidence of the defendant's relationship with the victims. The only evidence of any relationship is that Lauren Clark and Jessica Lee recognized the victims as fellow high school students of theirs. But there is no evidence in the record of what the defendant's relationship was with the victims, other than the fact that there was apparently some intent to get together that evening when their cars passed each other. But that does not, there's no other evidence about the defendant's relationship with the victims.
With regard to the cars passing each other, and another fact minutia point, is the record, as I understand the record, the question of who turned around first, you could kind of come to any conclusion. There's some evidence that the victim's car turned around first, or some evidence that they both turned around at the same time. Is that right?
Your Honor, Lauren Clark's testimony was is that the vehicles, when the vehicles passed each other initially, that the victims turned around first, and then the defendant turned around as the victims turned around. Then as they passed each other the second time, the defendant flashed his lights.
Well, if that were the sequence, that is a weaker inference that they actually had any prior plan or that he knew these people. Because I suppose if you're driving down the road and somebody turns around, you might think what's going on here and turn around if you don't do it first.
I don't know if that's a weaker inference, Your Honor, but the defendant was the one who flashed the lights.
Right.
And then the victim's car turned off. The defendant turned around for a second time and then followed them onto a side road. To continue answering your question, your previous question about evidence of premeditation as evidenced in the defendant's conduct leading up to the murders, he took a number of affirmative steps which indicated that at each opportunity he had an opportunity to reflect on his actions.
But again, you said opportunity. I want to know what the proof is that he did it as opposed to had an opportunity.
Well,
the only way we know whether someone actually reflects is if they say, I am reflecting, I am planning to kill you, and doing all of that. Now, I mean, I don't know. I say a lot of us that have been in court for a very long time, I've never actually seen someone come up to the door and say, well, now you're getting, you know, I'm planning to do this right now, and I thought about it all the way back to the car when I got the gun, and here I'm doing this.
Right, that's right.
There are such things as people who can testify that they saw him behave in a calm, deliberate manner, as the government purported to do in the brief on appeal when they said there was such evidence, which would have been, as the panel said, sufficient, at which point it became clear that the government was misrepresenting the facts. But those facts would have been sufficient.
Judge.
So that would answer Judge Callahan's question as to whether such evidence can exist, other than with a defendant admitting it.
You know, I read that part of the panel opinion, and I wasn't entirely persuaded, were you? I mean, does calmness have something to do with deliberation?
Well, the government obviously thought so, didn't it?
Your Honor, the government's characterization of the...
It may have, but we're now here now. I'm just wondering, why does being calm and cold-blooded suggest deliberation, whereas being excited suggests no deliberation? I don't quite get it.
Well, Your Honor,
probably a reasonable jury might be able to see a distinction between the two kinds of objective behavior, but...
That's correct. When the defendant is behaving in a manner that does not evidence frenzy, the converse, the jury can draw the inference that the defendant is calm. Specifically,
you don't have to be calm to deliberate. You can deliberate and you can be quite excited and still deliberate. People do it all the time. They're in life-threatening situations. You're climbing a mountain, one of your pylons slips, and then you're in life's, you're in mortal danger at that point, and you have to think clearly even while excited. I mean, I'm not sure I see those as flip sides of each other.
Your Honor, I agree that one does not have to have a calm demeanor to premeditate. What the government was arguing in its answering brief on direct appeal was that the defendant's conduct, as described by Lauren Clark, did not demonstrate that he acted in a frenzy.
Well, Lauren Clark didn't say anything, hardly, as to the actual interaction. I mean, he was way – he said he saw some black figure moving.
He saw the defendant walk back to the car, retrieve the rifle, walk back towards the victim's car. And this time, even though he was standing at the victim's driver's side door, this time walked and apparently targeted the passenger. That's another indication.
It would still be, I understand, as Judge Callahan says, that there's no direct evidence of premeditation, and there hardly ever will be. The question is, what is, and you began to say, Salvi, you never really finished, what is the evidence, circumstantial evidence, of premeditation, not of opportunity to premeditate, but of premeditation that a jury could rely on to find beyond a reasonable doubt that it occurred?
Well,
so one is that he went back to the car for the gun. Another is that he walked around the car.
That's correct.
Those are the two things you've mentioned. Anything else?
The fact that he shouldered the rifle and apparently with very deliberate purpose aimed the rifle. He struck the victim six of 8 or 9 times. And on that point,
but wait, can you just address, I mean, we're sitting here well after the fact, and you're characterizing, but what the prosecutor, were you the prosecutor? I don't think so.
No, Your Honor, I was not.
Okay, so what the prosecutor told the jury, interpreting the instructions, is that all the government has to prove is that the amount of time, that there was enough time for the person to form the intent to kill and to be conscious of the killing. What did the defendant do in this case? He goes up to the driver's side. He talks to someone in the vehicle. He walks back to his truck. He gets the rifle. He walks back around the car to the passenger side, puts it up on his shoulder, as you just said, fires multiple times into the vehicle. He knew exactly what he was doing. He intended to kill the occupants of the vehicle. That's premeditation. He intended it. He was conscious of it. That's first-degree murder. Is that a correct interpretation? Application of premeditation?
Your Honor, that is a correct characterization of the evidence and is a statement of premeditation, as the Ninth Circuit Model Instruction 8.89 says, that the killer has to be fully conscious of the intent and to have considered the killing. If that particular argument may have been inartfully made, but the jury was properly instructed on first-degree murder, and the prosecutor arguing the inferences and the evidence and applying it to the definition of first-degree murder, to the extent that there was any error, I would submit that it was harmless.
Well, when we're all having all this problem parsing the evidence, it seems to me it's hardly harmless if the prosecutor inartfully conflates intent to kill with premeditation, which seems to be the thrust of what the prosecutor was doing. So why wouldn't that have some weight in whether or not the jury was confused and therefore reached an inference of premeditation that was improperly skewed?
Well, again, the jury was correctly instructed by the court on the definition.
That's not answering the question. The question is, why doesn't it skew it if the prosecutor, who represents the United States, comes in and, as a matter of law, conflates the two elements? If the prosecutor doesn't understand it and misarticulates it, why would a lay jury be able to sort it out and follow the instructions when the prosecutor herself or himself couldn't do it as a professional a lawyer?
Your Honor, based upon the evidence, there was evidence that the ample evidence that the defendant had the opportunity and took affirmative steps which indicated that he considered the killing and implemented his plan to carry out.
You said that the judge explained it properly. What did the judge say about premeditation?
Your Honor, the judge instructed the jury consistent with Ninth Circuit Model Instruction 8.89.
What did he say about premeditation?
Your Honor, I believe that he told the jury that the defendant had to.
You know what he told the jury, or you believe?
I don't have the instruction in front of me, Your Honor.
Well, I do. I don't think he said anything other than they must find premeditation, but I might be wrong.
Was this premeditation? Didn't he tell the jury premeditation means planning or deliberation? I have the instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's correct.
So he told the jury he had to plan.
And premeditate. Yeah, that's correct.
Deliberate.
What did the defense – we've talked about what the prosecutor argued. What did the defense argue in terms of – in their closing argument about this issue?
The defense did not raise the issue of premeditation. The only argument the defense counsel made on behalf of the defendant was that the defendant was not the murderer. The defense strategy was to portray the government's witnesses as unreliable, either because they had that they had some motivation to lie, or that they were drunk, or a combination of the above.
And was there an objection? Was there an objection to the prosecutor's argument about premeditation?
No, Your Honor. There was no objection during the prosecutor's closing argument.
So the prosecutor says what – it was she, right? It was a
– Yes, Your Honor.
Says what she says. There's no objection. There's no chance to correct at that point. And do we infer from that that people sitting in the courtroom understood the prosecutor's argument to be what she was saying is there you have premeditation in the sense that you can draw the inference of premeditation? This was argument rather than instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor. This was, again, the prosecutor. When the prosecutor made those statements, she was arguing the application of the facts that the jury could draw the inference that the defendant had premeditated the killing. And again, the court instructed the jury properly. The defense did not make any argument concerning deliberation whatsoever or premeditation whatsoever. The defense's only argument at trial to the jury was that it was misidentification, that the defendant was not present at the scene.
Are you – what other case would you regard as most similar to this one in which a first-degree murder was upheld, given – I mean, what strikes me about – what's – and I said this before, but what's really odd about this case is we have no idea what the motive was, what the relationship was, what the reason for the murder was, what – and so on. Is there any case with that many gaps, holes, vacuums, in terms of the things one would ordinarily know that would lead to a conclusion of premeditation?
Your Honor, the Shaw case from the Fifth Circuit, which involved a defendant apparently randomly sniping at a vehicle as it passed by, in that case the defense argued that the defendant was shooting at deer and that it was apparently an accidental shooting. There was no apparent motive for that random killing, and the Fifth Circuit found that there was premeditation in support of a first-degree murder conviction.
Wasn't that Sinclair case you cited pretty good, too?
Yes, Judge. I submit that it is. The Sinclair case is very similar on its facts with one important difference. The first, in Sinclair, there was irrefutable evidence of provocation because the defendant and the victim were fighting before the defendant was ejected from a bar and then returned with a gun moments later.
So would that be an appropriate time to give a voluntary manslaughter instruction? Would those be facts sufficient to give rise to giving a voluntary manslaughter instruction?
In that case, where there was affirmative evidence of provocation, I agree that a voluntary manslaughter instruction may have been appropriate. In this case, again, there is an absolute dearth of evidence of provocation. As the court heard, defense counsel never argued
Does it matter that the defendant was – that the defense was that he didn't do it as opposed to that he was provoked? Does that matter in terms of what a court considers in deciding whether to give a voluntary manslaughter instruction?
Absolutely. I think it's a very, very relevant factor. I mean, the first hurdle is that there has to be some evidence in the record of provocation to warrant the instruction in the first place. But again, this entire line of argument, which is raised on appeal, was not introduced at any point.
There was no request for a provocation voluntary manslaughter instruction, right?
There was a request for the instruction. That's correct, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
There was a request for that.
There was a request.
Which the court denied. And at that point, defense counsel apparently abandoned any argument about voluntary manslaughter. However, the defense never raised again any issue, any argument to the jury about premeditation.
But you would concede, let's say perhaps, that, you know, sometimes defendants take defense postures that don't work, but there are still facts before a jury. Let's say in Sinclair, if the person's position was, you know, they misidentified me, I wasn't the shooter. But the other evidence in the trial was that the person that was the shooter had a bar fight before, then went out to the car. In that situation, the court still has to, if there is evidence, even though the defendant's not taking that position, has to consider whether to give that voluntary manslaughter, right?
I agree. Again, that is not the case here, because there was no evidence of provocation. I'd like to point the court to...
The jury was not instructed on transferred intent. Is that true?
I am not sure if they were. That issue was with transferred intent with respect to the driver of the vehicle.
Yes. I didn't see it.
I don't believe that was an issue, and so it was an issue raised on appeal. So,
the prosecutor did make that argument in closing argument. The prosecutor said that the intent to kill one of them, which presumably is JT, transfers to, and the intent to kill OC.
Right, and
right, but they weren't instructed on that, were they?
I don't know that they were. The defense conceded on direct appeal that was not an issue.
What they're instructed was that you can find him guilty of first-degree murder even if you find the intent to kill only one of the victims. He's guilty of the first-degree murder for Atisha Chi if he killed her while acting with malice aforethought and with premeditation the killing of Gerald Tallman. So that's the instruction, right?
And again, the defense conceded that was not an issue in direct appeal.
The government conceded that the killing of the driver was accidental at sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor. It appears that the intended target of the shooting was the passenger. With respect to the defendant's intent, about 5 months after the murders, the defendant had a confrontation with an individual named Larry Begay, not a relation of his, and the defendant stated that, "I killed some people and I got away with it, and I can kill again." The jury was entitled to take that piece of evidence as an insight into the defendant's mindset, which sort of colors...
I don't understand how that addresses anything having to do with premeditation.
It indicates, or at least it demonstrated to the jury, that this was not an individual who appears to have acted on impulse or otherwise harbored any remorse, and it demonstrates his intent to kill another person.
I thought we had case law that suggests that you can't backstop premeditation with post-murder evidence.
That is true, but this gives what this does is it simply gives the jury a greater picture of who the defendant is. It's something that the jury was entitled to consider, maybe if not imputing premeditation.
Well, but are you asking us to put that in the calculus of premeditation? Put that statement? Apart from, I killed somebody, are you asking us to put into the premeditation calculus, and I could kill somebody again?
Only to the extent that the defendant was threatening to kill another person.
So what?
In the future.
Maybe that would be relevant if the next day he went out and killed somebody else. But how is that relevant to to a murder that took place before the statement.
It certainly refutes in part the defendant's claim, at least his counsel's claim, that the defendant simply acted on an impulse out of character.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it could mean, you know, I killed somebody in a rage before, got away with it, and now I'm emboldened, and now that I know that I can get away with killing people, I'm going to do it deliberately. That's certainly one possible inference. I mean, I guess another inference could be, I'm threatening to do this deliberate killing now, and let me tell you, I've done this before, the same thing before, which is another inference that one can draw, but it's pretty weak, all of it.
Your Honor, the evidence, as the Court is aware, and as Neville's recently reiterated, the Court has to look at all of the evidence as a whole, the evidence in the totality. The evidence that the defendant clearly appeared to have some business with the victims, signaled, isolated the victims on the road.
Why does that help you in premeditation? I don't understand that, because if he premeditated and had business, he would have taken the gun to the car in the first place. Why doesn't that show that if intent were formed, the intent was formed at the car, not beforehand?
The government's best argument is, and I submit that the jury was entitled to find premeditation, as you point out, from the point the defendant stood
right. I mean,
next to the vehicle.
Isn't really the whole case on premeditation? What happened at the car and when the defendant walked to his own car, retrieved the rifle, and came back? We can't consider what happened later, what he said to people. And we really can't consider what happened before, because that tends to go the other way, it would seem to me.
You're correct, Your Honor. The strongest evidence of premeditation is what happened at the scene. The defendant's act of bringing the rifle from the truck is essentially akin to the other case law, which finds premeditation when someone brings a weapon to the crime scene. The crime scene is at the passenger side of the vehicle when the defendant discharges 8 or 9 rounds into the car. There was deliberate and premeditated action in the manner of carrying out the killing. The number of shots.
Isn't that where I agree with you? The issue is: is there anything that shows premeditation between the time he left the car and the time that he killed the people? Now, agree. There's time and opportunity. Now, what other evidence is there that it was deliberate planning rather than acting in an emotional state? I mean, what evidence? Now, I know you say, well, there are two possibilities, so you can pick either one. But the question is, if the issue is solely premeditation, and you have two, anything could have happened, what evidence is there that it's premeditation rather than not acting in a cool and deliberate manner? Or is it just that you say you can take an inference of either one?
Your Honor, the role of this Court in conducting a constitutional sufficiency analysis is to construe the facts in favor of the prosecution.
Okay. Does that mean the answer is none, that there's no evidence as to what happened between the time he left the side of the car and the time he shot them, and that that has to be done entirely by inference?
It's circumstantial evidence, and it is drawn by inference, and if this Court concludes that there are two inferences, even reasonable inferences, that can be drawn from the defendant's conduct, then Jackson and Neville's mandates.
All right. I was just asking the first question. There's no evidence. You say it's just a permissible inference.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In addition to the manner, you can infer it from his conduct, can't you? His purposeful, organized behavior. He wasn't carrying on. He wasn't screaming. He wasn't. There was no evidence of provocation, as counsel said, so you can infer that he must have been thinking about what he was doing by what he did and what he did in the insufficient amount of time.
That's correct, Judge. Not only is it an inference, I submit that the jury, as it did, was entitled to infer that it was
a compelling inference. It was a very strong inference.
I'm just kind of surprised to hear you say things. I mean, evidence is direct and circumstantial evidence. So you could say there was no direct evidence, but if you say there's no evidence, you lose.
No, there is circumstantial evidence, Your Honor.
Right. Well, so that's evidence. I mean, isn't the law that that's evidence just like direct evidence is evidence?
Of course. And this Court and every circuit has held that premeditation.
But when you say it is a – what you also said was that a jury could reasonably infer it either way. But we have a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, and that's where I keep getting hung up. Okay. I mean, what is there that would make a jury reasonably conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that this was premeditation?
Your Honor, if the question is not whether under – as Neville's clarifies, the question is not whether a jury may have interpreted the evidence and drawn the inferences from the evidence, circumstantial or direct, to reach an acquittal. That's not the analysis. The Court on the first prong of Jackson, as set forth in Neville's, is to view the evidence in favor of the prosecution, not view the evidence in favor of innocence.
Yes, but to go back to what we were saying before, there are stronger inferences and weaker inferences, and that somehow has to feed into the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So the fact that a jury could sort of without basis infer, without sufficient basis to meet a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, say, well, it must be that he considered it, can't be the answer. The inference can't be good enough because if it isn't strong enough to support a beyond a reasonable doubt conclusion, no?
Your Honor, under the second prong of Jackson, the only way that this Court would reverse, could reverse the jury's verdict is to find that no rational trier of fact could have viewed the evidence in favor of the prosecution and determined beyond a reasonable doubt that there was evidence of
Thank you.
Premeditation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The question was raised, is a vacuum sufficient? And the answer is no. A vacuum in terms of premeditation state of mind is not sufficient for two reasons. Number one, there is no presumption that any given homicide is a premeditated one. So a vacuum.
Yeah, but this is not a vacuum. The guy is sitting there talking or whatever with the car. He walks back. This is a truck, right? So he has to get to the back seat. This is a cab.
Dodge extended cab truck.
I'm sorry?
Dodge extended cab truck.
So this is two doors, or I mean, he has a second door that he has to open, reach under the seat to get his rifle, walks back, walks around to the other side of the car. And obviously is shooting at the passenger, not the driver. I mean, hits the driver because the bullet passes through the passenger into the driver. So it's not like he just starts sort of shooting at the car. He actually goes to the very place where his likely where one of the victims is, the one that he is clearly aiming at. Why is that enough? I don't see what's so weak or a vacuum or particularly difficult. Well, why isn't that sort of the only reasonable inference that one could draw, which is not nearly necessary to sustain the verdict?
Because it only shows he has the intent to kill the passenger. It doesn't show what his state of mind is in having that intent to kill.
He walks back to get the rifle.
It doesn't show.
How much clearer can it be? He goes back, stops what he's doing and interacting with the people in the car, and trounces back and finds the rifle, gets back, goes around to the other side. What more do you need? What possible other inference can one reasonably draw than that he deliberated and sat there and planned to kill this guy?
That he was provoked by something that occurred while he was standing by
the
car.
But is provocation the negate deliberation? I don't see. He could be provoked into doing something quite deliberate. I mean, it's one thing to say you walk in, you find your spouse in flagrante delicto, you happen to have a gun holstered and you
pull it out and shoot them right there. You say, well, maybe, you know, it's a, quite different as you find them a flagrante delicto and say, oh, I've got a gun locker in the basement. Go to the basement, work the gun locker, load the bullets, walk back up and shoot them. At that point, you premeditated. And isn't this very much like that case?
No, but I can make it like this case. Let's say you walk into the bedroom, you find your spouse in flagrante delicto, and there's a gun in the closet, comparable to the distance between the two cars here. You walk over to the closet, you grab the gun, you walk over to the bed, bang, you shoot, kill the spouse. This could be perfectly consistent with a killing that occurs in the face of provocation adequate to drive a reasonable person to kill.
That I'm sorry?
Adequate to drive a reasonable person to kill. It could be voluntary manslaughter.
It could be, but the very fact that you thought about where the gun was and you remembered, oh, I've got a gun in the closet, I'm going to walk over there and get it, I'm going to come back, cock it, and shoot. Why can't reasonable people sitting around a jury room, a table in a jury room, say, yeah, you know, he planned it?
If there were any evidence that he planned it,
the difference between the two, that it could have been either, but you need proof, evidence that it's premeditated.
Exactly.
You don't prove an element of a crime by saying, oh, well, it's possible it could have been proven, but we're not going to have any evidence to prove it.
Exactly. That's why a vacuum is not enough. If the
high I'm not sure what Judge Reinhart just said, that you said exactly to.
I'm agreeing with what Judge Reinhart said.
I understand, but I didn't understand what he
That the way you prove something is evidence. And you don't go and say, well, when he went to the closet and came back, you know, he may have done it with deliberation, he may not have done it with deliberation, but we'll just leave that up to a jury to guess without any evidence as to which.
I agree with that.
I know.
Well, you may agree with that, but I don't understand why. Because you don't, you know, there's not a little balloon over your head with words saying, I'm thinking, I'm deliberating.
Maybe that's why most convictions for murder and most charges for murder are second degree. And first degree is rare.
Exactly. And what there can be, there's no thought bubble, but there can be planning, there can be motive. There can be a manner of killing.
How much more planning do you need than going back to the car, rooting around for the rifle, coming back, going to the other side? How much more do you need?
Enough planning to enable a reasonable jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the killer acted with a cool mind, capable of reflection, and did in fact report.
I think you could have had a juror of 120 people, and you would not have had a disagreement on this one.
Say it again?
Even if there had been 10 juries, put this to 10 different juries, I don't see how reasonable people can draw any other inference.
If 10 juries were
understood that you need more than what's enough for second-degree murder, and they understood what it meant to have a calm, cool mind, as opposed to doing it with the own kind of reflection that gets second-degree murder, maybe every juror would have gone the other way. Maybe not Judge Kaczynski.
Well, I agree, and I think that if 10 juries were told that intent to kill is premeditation, then 10 juries probably would have reached the same conclusion.
Well,
but that's not the law.
Well, maybe if Henry Fonda had been on the jury.
Say again?
Maybe if Henry Fonda had been on the jury. Anyway, we're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case just argued, stand submitted. We are adjourned.
All rise.